frustrating for all of us to see, but really I think our team and engineering and traffic management group and everyone here in leadership at Sotoli really went above and beyond to not only identify that the bridge at the time that it was hit was structurally stable and didn't pose a risk to drivers, but also to quickly expedite repairs and replacement of the parts of the bridge that had been damaged. We're able to accomplish that bridge beam removal in coordination with, again, of course, the Illinois State Police, the Illinois Department of Transportation, local municipalities and officials from nearby O'Hare International Airport, and we want to thank them all for their assistance. Another closure will be required later this summer to install a new beam and restore the bridge to its previous condition. I think John Benda has more information about the repair project, including a dramatic technical video. No, I've seen it. It is dramatic video of the beam removal. And John, if you want to go through this exciting and out of the norm project for the tollway.
Hard to follow the last presentation, but I guarantee you it will be better than the next presentation. Greg Duke was actually going to come up and help me with his presentation. I'm really challenged about doing this. Is this turned on?
I think Nancy will give you the powers on the side. I guess there's a power button on the side.
I withdraw my comment.
I can do it.
There you go. Okay, the Balboa Avenue Bridge, which is just south of the O'Hare Interchange on the Tri-State Tollway, was struck at 1:20 on Monday, June 3rd. That's the truck that struck the bridge. It did extensive damage to the first beam northbound, which is called the fascia beam on the bridge structure. Maintenance crews responded and began immediately removing it. This caused all the lanes northbound on the tri-state to be closed immediately because of the concrete debris that was scattered about, as well as parts of the truck. So maintenance responded from several actual garages eventually, and we concentrated initially on removing debris under the left shoulder and left wing so that we could restore traffic at least to a certain extent. So at 2:36, a little over an hour, we were able to get two lanes back using the left shoulder and lane one at that location. And what you see are the crews, these are actually welding crews that are actually up there removing debris, and then we began the task of wrapping the remainder of the beam. We did extensive removal of concrete above the shoulder in the lane, but then we actually wrapped the remainder of the beam to keep additional debris from falling so that we could reopen lanes. And that's actually a picture looking up at the cyclone fence and the filter fabric that actually is lining that fence that we use. And we literally drill into the underside of the bridge and attach that mechanically to keep debris from falling. That effort took about 5 hours. And we eventually opened up all lanes of the tri-state at about 8:49 on that Monday afternoon. We determined that the bridge was going to have to be repaired on an emergency basis, and Greg's going to walk us through that process a little bit, and then I'll talk about some of the traffic efforts.
Okay. It was an emergency, so this is handled by emergency affidavit, so we work with procurement and other departments here at the tollway to get that going. We had to identify a contractor to make the repairs. The obvious choice to us was Lord Construction. Lord built the bridge back in the early 90s. This bridge was actually hit, same beam, in November of 96, and Lord performed the repairs of when that was for that damage. Lord also recently completed widening of this bridge to the north on the Balmoral Interchange in 2011. So we had to develop a plan. The plan was to remove the beam as quickly as possible, order a replacement beam. The beam was ordered June 10th, and the beam was scheduled for fabrication this week. And we wanted to get the repair done by August 1st because Rosemont has a planned grand opening for an outlet mall on August 1st. Okay, we had to determine the removal method. The last time they did it, they used cranes to try to lower the beam. We decided this time that we were just going to drop the beam on crane mats. So we put large timbers on the pavement in order to make sure that the pavement wasn't damaged. That required a full closure. I'll turn it back to John.
Once it was determined we're going to have to close the entire road, we took a look at the entire week to see when the best time was to do that, and then the best time was going to be Saturday night into Sunday. The only major event that was going on that evening was the Blackhawks playoff game, which we originally thought would be over well enough that it would not impact the actual total closure. But we did look at some other routes, and we talked with Business Systems, and you will see through this entire effort tremendous coordination and cooperation between multiple towway departments and multiple agencies outside the towway. We looked at diverting traffic on I-88 west to 355 north, but that would have hooked people for another potential toll at Army Trail Road. After some discussions, and not lengthy discussions, just brief discussions with one of my counterparts at IDOT, they said, well, go ahead and use 290. So we struck a deal, and they allowed us to, with verbal authorization, plan on the deployment of various signs along 290, connecting back eventually up to 90 and then back down to the airport in that direction. Our consultant, CDM Smith, worked with us and put together a traffic plan. We carefully looked at all the numbers to make sure that when we started taking a lane out of service, either for the prep work for the closure or for the total closure, that we're going to minimize impact to our customers. And so that's what drove this. Probably best exemplified or shown on this map, it's tough to see, but each of those squares represents a messaging zone, and we used a total of around 25 dynamic message signs, our signs, IDOT signs, the Indiana Department of Transportation signs, to provide advance warning to motorists that this closure was going to occur on Saturday night. And then as the closure got closer, the messages were changed on these signs to reflect actual conditions at the site, and then actual the full closure and the detour. Where we didn't have dynamic message signs available, we put portable changeable message signs. And IDOT was very helpful in allowing us to quickly place those on their system without requiring formal permits or anything. So a significant effort in getting the word out. Communication was also instrumental early on in this, in working with us, working with the airport, and making sure that we got the message out to the media. The media was tremendously helpful in getting the word out, so that I don't think anybody in northeastern Illinois didn't know we were going to be closing the northbound tri-state on Saturday night. And this is the first time the tollway has ever, to my knowledge, formally actually closed and detoured a segment of the system. Not that we want to keep doing that in the future, but we did that and it seemed to work. You want to walk through the timeline?
Okay, on Saturday, June 8th, at 7 p.m., we did a two-lane closure northbound to allow the contractor to mobilize some equipment and get started on the work. 8 p.m., we did a two-lane closure southbound in order to provide him with some buffer zone. 9:30 p.m., while we closed the eastbound direction on the Balmoral Avenue, so the contractor was able to stage his equipment up on top of the bridge. 10 p.m., we did a three-lane closure northbound so that he was able to actually start setting some crane mats out there on the pavement. 11:10 was when the Blackhawks won in overtime. We were watching that because we were actually watching the traffic surge to see if that was going to impact the detour that we had planned. 11:30, northbound Cermak Road, Toll Plaza, open road tolling lanes. We detoured traffic. We closed the ORT and detoured traffic through the cash lanes. We also did a left lane of the two-lane ramp from the eastbound Reagan Memorial to northbound Tri-State closed. And at 12 o'clock midnight, then the detour began, all as planned. On Sunday, by 12:12, so it took us about 12 minutes to flush the traffic out, the contractor was able to begin his work. And less than 2 hours later, at 2:05, he dropped the beam. By 3:30, we were able to open all southbound lanes on the tri-state. 5:30 a.m., we were able to open two lanes on the northbound, so we were able to shut down the detour, and everything was cleaned up by 7:32 a.m. Sunday morning.
Okay, this is a time-lapse video. You'll notice the crane that's down on the bottom of the road. When we actually get to the point where the beam falls, it'll slow down so you can see it. But what's happening right now is the contractor, Lorig, is detaching the parapet portion and the fascia beam portion from the abutment here and from the center pier connection there. And then you'll see there's hammers. These are crane-mounted hammers or backhoe-mounted hammers that are actually moving down the line of actually where they last replaced and surgically replaced that beam, so they were able to actually follow the joint line in order to separate the beam from the remainder of the structure. Their process also then called for them to cut through the center so that they could potentially drop in a controlled manner one half and then the other half of the beam. And as you see, they're making great progress. Again, this was 2 hours of removal that is compressed into about a minute and a half. you notice the beam just dropped down a little bit and started binding in the center. You'll see in a few moments another unit coming in from the bottom. And the little sparks you see, little flashes of light, those are people with welding torches cutting the large volume of reinforcing steel from the original bridge and from the pin replacement and repair that was done several years ago. And here we go. The hammer from the bottom, boom. Oh, it didn't slow down. Now they're working on the final piece right along the center of the structure. In the video we showed the FAO committee, it actually slowed down, and for some reason this is not the same presentation, so you will not unfortunately see the cleanup. We did have a video of the cleanup activities, but let me do comment that Lorig did a phenomenal job of not only dropping the beam in a very controlled, safe manner, but they looked like an army of ants afterwards. There was very little wasted motion from 2 o'clock until 5:30 when they had lanes, started opening up lanes. It was an amazing effort on the part of their crew, as well as a concerted effort on the part of our resources. All lanes were open. Currently on the tri-state, one lane is continues to be closed on Balmoral because obviously we're missing the one beam. The beam is in fabrication right now, and as Greg mentioned earlier, we hope to have the new beam installed later this month or later July in time for the August 1 opening. That's going to be very ambitious to try and accomplish, so I don't want to increase an expectation of beyond what we may be able to do, but we're going to try and do that, so we'll see what happens. I can't stress enough what a phenomenal effort in terms of cooperation between the various entities, not only my operation and maintenance and traffic, and we had some 30 employees manning various road closures and detours that night, as well as 8 staff. Most of the CA staff were involved. The incident manager ran things from the traffic center. We had it all on camera, and we were able to monitor activities, and things really went without a hitch. We had one minor crash that occurred right before the Blackhawks won, because I was out on the road and ended up stopping for the crash. And in retrospect, I think the agency should have sent me to the United Center so I could monitor the progress of that game in preparation for this effort. But excellent effort. I can't say enough about just about everybody on this list and others. The airport is not listed here, but they're very cooperative in working with communication. Several people in our communication department did a phenomenal job. State police in coordinating, providing resources. Village of Rosemont, their engineers were on scene right after the hit, and they were very helpful with us in evaluating the condition of the bridge initially. And then very cooperative with their police department coming out throughout the entire emergency removal effort on Saturday night. So A very difficult situation, unfortunate, frustrating, but overall we think we handled it well and minimized the disruption to our customers in the process. So, with that, that's it.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Well, Director Peterson had raised at the committee meeting whether there was a way of having a state law passed to make sure that all trucks have to be equipped with something that tells them if their dumpster's up. Do you know if there are any, I'll think about it later, are there any states that do have that?
There are very, I'm not sure if there's any states that actually require that or not, but we have not been able to research and find that out. There are some state laws that govern activities of truckers hauling materials involving covering loads and things like that. So it would not be that unusual for a law to focus on something like that. Certainly, we've had some bad experience with dump trucks driving with their box in the air. This truck was hauling screenings. He was not one of our subcontractors, but he was hauling from off our system and using our system as transport. And the box just went up and missed the two overhead sign structures that are before the bridge, but unfortunately were high enough to contact the bridge. So that's something we could pursue in introducing legislation. We would probably want to talk to IDOT and see what kind of experience they've had and whether that's something, because both agencies would really need to support that.
Do you say we require anybody doing work, any contractors on the tollway, they need to have that warning system to their beds if they're up?
Yeah, as a result of last year's experience, our Traffic Operations Safety Committee reviewed what we currently do, and we're actually looking at it from two standpoints. One, to prevent it from happening, and two, to potentially assess lost revenue when it does happen due to negligence. And we have modified, we're in the process of modifying our specifications to require that any dump truck calling and working on our system, either as a contractor or subcontractor, will have to have a warning device, either audible or visual, in the cab indicating when the PTO is engaged and the box is in the air. So we've done that as an additional safeguard for our work. Unfortunately, it wouldn't have applied to this guy because he was not under contract with us. But that is a new contractual requirement that we've implemented.
Any other questions or comments? Great job.
Thank you.
And now last but not least.
What we've all been waiting for.
Presentation by Finance Chief Mike Kelsch. He's going to provide an update on our refunding efforts. As you know, in the last week, interest rates have significantly increased. But, you know, we'll continue to monitor in the coming weeks and see if there's an opportunity for the refunding to, you know, move forward. We do think that there is potentially an opportunity to save some money. So Mike is going to tell us a little bit more and talk to us a little bit about it.
Thank you. And that might have been the fairest comment that John's made to me in a long time. As Christy mentioned, we did have a discussion last week at the FAO committee. And we wanted to start by reminding you that we had a resolution earlier in the year to authorize up to $1 billion in bonds to refund 2005A and 2006A series bonds. We at the time had noted that the 2005 bonds were the most likely to be refunded, that each of these series have call dates, which means call dates that are in effect in the case of 2005 in 2 years, and in the case of 2006 bonds in 3 years. And it's really the call date that's important because that's the point at which you can actually effectively lower the interest rate on the new refunding bonds that you issue. So there is a window that we do have until the call dates, until we can call these bonds out. Some of the considerations that we are factoring in to this review it is obviously that with respect to the interest rates on the 2005 and 2006 bonds, the current interest rate is 5%. And even with recent changes in the bond market, similar maturities now are priced to yield between 2 and 4%. So it would seem that we should have an opportunity to save significant amounts of money based upon those changes in rates. One factor, however, is that rates have increased, quite significantly in the period of June 18th to June 25th. In fact, the Bond Buyer magazine reported that it was the largest three-day kind of loss in the bond market in terms of prices in the last 25 years during that period. The market reacted to comments that were made by Federal Reserve Chair Bernanke related to the stimulus activity that the Federal Reserve has with respect to the economy. They have a bond buying program in which they purchase treasury and mortgage bonds at the rate of about $85 billion per month, which provides stimulus to the economy and obviously keeps interest rates low because of their activity out there buying and competing for bonds. His comments led investors and the market to believe that that stimulus program, that bond-backed program, may end more quickly than the market had anticipated previously, and the market reacted quite quickly to those comments. Additional technical factors in the municipal market is that there was a large supply of municipal bonds in the market on the forward-looking calendar. And recently, investors have started moving out of municipal bonds and into stocks and equity funds as they see the economy improving and the prospects for returns to be greater in stocks and equities. So all of those issues kind of led to this adjustment in the market last week. One of the things that that we do have a positive aspect to waiting is that we have a significant amount of negative arbitrage right now, which is depressing or reducing the potential savings. And this is the fact, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but this is the fact that if we advance refund, or we issue these refunding bonds in advance of the call date, we have to put proceeds in an escrow, that escrow earns interest until the call date, and so you can actually take the old bonds out. Well, that escrow, the short-term interest rates are so low that escrow earns a lot less than what we pay, even at these lower rates, on the new bonds that we would issue. So the shorter you make that escrow, the less you lose as a result of what we call negative arbitrage. Early last week, well, we anticipated that market rates for the tollway bonds would have produced about $35 million of present value savings from refunding five of the eight 2005 callable maturities. Those maturities totaled about $525 million. Each of them had present value savings of 4% or more, and each of them had savings that represented 50% or more of the potential savings. And the negative arbitrage accounted for less than half of the savings, the potential savings. So that's the criteria we used in developing that list of potential candidates. Assuming the June 24th interest rates, which was Monday since we prepared this yesterday, refunding the same 2005A maturities would produce present value savings of $13 million. And the savings, as I mentioned, are impacted significantly by an inefficient refunding escrow, which produced negative arbitrage of approximately $27 million. So at this point, at the point of June 24th, the realized savings would have only been about a third of the potential. The positive, if there's positive news out of this, is that the bond market yesterday, and again this morning, as I just checked, has rebounded quite significantly, probably gaining back about a little more than a third of what that loss was last week. This is a slide we tried to show last week but couldn't bring up. And in the FAO committee, we wanted to make the point that while rates in the last couple of months had started to trend up, that by historical standards, rates during 2013 have remained favorable, but as you can see by the next slide, they did increase sharply last week. You can see June 18th, hopefully at the bottom, you can see the point where it starts to to spike up there, and then you can see at the end on June 24th and 25th the reduction in rates that we experienced yesterday. This is pretty probably very difficult to read on the screen. You may be able to read it on your slides on your laptops. What this shows is that high interest rates, higher interest rates and negative arbitrage have reduced savings. This is the list of five candidates in yellow. Savings total $13 million, and the loss and the negative arbitrage totals $27 million. And this reflects kind of the peak level of interest rates that we experienced over the last week. So it would represent kind of the lowest level of savings we would project recently. Now, if we were to carry, to give you some comfort, hopefully, if we were to carry those rates, the highest rates in the last week, forward and say that there would be no change in interest rates at all between now and the call date, which we all know is unlikely, but just to give you an idea of the impact of negative arbitrage, if those rates remain precisely the same and we sold then bonds to refund at the call date, that savings would increase from $13 million to $60 million with no change in interest rates. And that's due to two factors. One, you eliminate all the negative arbitrage because you don't have an escrow. If you sell the bonds at right at the time you're going to call the bonds. Right? And the second factor is as you wait, the length of the bonds or the duration of the bonds that you sell is shorter. So they carry lower interest rates because you move down the yield curve. The yield curve is typically upward sloping. So all of that kind of technical discussion, I think, is just background for there are factors weighing against moving, or factors pointing, encouraging us to move quickly, which is the general level of interest rates may continue to rise over time. And factors suggesting that we need to be careful about how quickly we move because the opportunity has not been lost. The call dates are still 2 and 3 years away, and that by reducing the length of the escrow, we can enhance the potential savings. Previously, I think we all thought it would be best to move forward because we were at historic lows on interest rates. And so our plans at this point are to reconvene with our financial advisors and our underwriters tomorrow morning to have another market discussion. We had expected to post online our preliminary official statements, which is the offering document, on June 25th, and we had anticipated being prepared to price by the 2nd of July with an expectation we may price the next week. So at this point, what we'll do is we expect to meet with the financial advisors again and the underwriters to see whether or not that continuing improvement, the market continuing to improve today as well as it did yesterday, and then determine whether or not we should print the official statement and be prepared to move within a week or so of that printing of the official statement.
So like the board basically has already given you approval to move ahead and do the refunding on these. Now with the timing issue, did you see the market this week? Is this just an aberration? Is this a blip right now? Or what are our financial advisors telling us up to last week? What were they saying?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that I think all agree on. And that's evidenced by what's happened in the market the last couple of days. One is that the reaction to the comments by Federal Reserve Chair Bernanke in the market may have gone a little farther than the kind of technical aspects of the economy would indicate. And so there was a correction both in the municipal market and in the Treasury market. Although still a concern that over the long term there's going to have to be a general rise in interest rates. But the other factor here was that the municipal market really lagged the Treasury market. And the ratio between, or the prices of municipal bonds suffered even more than Treasuries for a number of technical factors. And I think our advisors and underwriters would agree that even if the Treasury market doesn't move, that the municipal market should improve a little just to get back in line with that Treasury bond market. So there's certainly a potential for improvements over the next few weeks. It's already materialized, like I mentioned earlier. About a third of that loss was recovered just yesterday, and it seems to be improving this morning, although I hesitate to say that because it's been an hour since I've checked. So our plan would be to, I think at this point we would consult with them on whether they think it's appropriate to go ahead and print and be prepared to price when on a day-to-day basis, really. We'll monitor it day-to-day.
Other questions or comments? I would like to have a board member involved in those discussions if we could accommodate Director Peterson's schedule or somebody else, anybody else from the board who might be involved. This is really ends up being a judgment call based on your expertise, Bill's expertise, Christy, Mike. It's an expensive judgment call, and our financial advisors and our underwriters I have a lot of confidence in, but I do think the board also has a fiduciary responsibility here, so I think sure. It's important to have somebody from the board involved, just hearing what's going on and then being involved in the judgment call. So if you're willing to do that, that's great. And anybody else who would like to suffer the perils of the stock market vicariously through this hallway, you're welcome to join in that exercise.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Do you have anything else?
I don't have anything else.
Okay.
Not at this time. We'll have a presentation from Shauna a bit later, I think. But
so what we'll do is we'll run through the consent agenda on finance and procurement, and then when we get to business systems, we'll have Shauna's presentation. I always give my little statement. These have been through the committees, and they have been examined closely. They are good questions and analysis, so it feels as if we're rushing through them very quickly, except I think the second one, that the procurement, we need to pause and discuss.
Sure.
The rest will take quite quickly. So on the first one under finance, any questions or comments? May I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions or recusals? Okay, procurement, let's take number one. Any questions or comments on that one? May I have a motion?
Motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions, recusals? Okay, let's take up number two.
Okay. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Okay, yeah, this item wasn't ready for committee, but it's ready this morning. So this item is an award of a tolling invitation for bid to purchase Payment Card Industry, PCI, compliance analysis. This contract provides a qualified PCI assessor to annually assess the tolling's compliance with payment card industry data security standards. Specifically, the vendor shall complete a PCI report on compliance and attestation of compliance with the tollway submission to our credit card processors. This compliance report relates to the security of credit card information that's processed. The vendor will also review and assess PCI required internal policies and systems to ensure best practices are being applied. Award is recommended to McGladrey LLP in a total amount not to exceed $212,400 for a four-year term.
Any questions on this one? Okay, may I hear a motion?
Motion to approve. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Have you got a question?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay. Any opposed? Abstention or recusal? Okay. I think we can take three and four together. Okay. May I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Recusal or abstention? Okay. Great.
Well, we're pleased to have Business Assistance Chief Shauna Whitehead here to present the next contract. The contract is with Accenture, and it's to implement and maintain a new customer service and toll violations processing system for the Illinois Tollway. Governor Quinn and his board have made it clear that customer service needs to be a top priority, and improving customer service needs to be a priority. And we think that a new system will allow us and the tollway to explore new customer-focused solutions and give us the flexibility that we need to find new ways to serve our customers in the years to come. The innovations are coming fast and furious for this industry, and we want to be able to have a system that's flexible enough to integrate those as we see them coming. This contract is another critical step, but certainly not the last step in this process. We were fortunate to have a great competition for this procurement. Accenture will be a great partner for us, but we had a lot of very high caliber businesses that stepped up and did a great job. It was selection process that we were all happy with because there was so much competition, and that was helpful to us. We always like to see that. So Sean is going to tell us a little bit more, walk through the presentation, and of course, if there are questions, she's happy and we're happy to address those.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk through this contract. I know it's been a long time coming. I think we first started talking about the procurement effort in a serious way back in 2011 with the board, and talking through why we wanted to undertake a major procurement, how we wanted to maximize competition, and those types of things. I will say that we are very grateful to everyone who responded and participated in this. The electronic tolling industry is actually relatively small, and you meet the same people over and over again, and we really rely on everyone in that community, our other tolling partner organizations, the vendor community, everyone, especially as we work toward national interoperability. And again, we're just grateful for everyone who participated. So this presentation is intended to help jog some of our memories, because I know we've talked about some of this before, and also to provide some context, because this is a big moment for us at the tollway, and I think maybe in the industry, because we are a very big electronic tolling organization. We have been talking about this timeline, and I think everyone has seen it time and again for almost the last 2 years, and we're at that fourth from the last line, where it says transition to new contracts and system implementation. We have been working toward all of this for a long time, and we are ready to award a contract and start the implementation of a new back office system that will replace what we currently have today, which we described when we originally talked about this in 2011 as bursting at the seams. What we have today is not something that can really take us into the future from an evolving business practice sort of viewpoint, and certainly not in the Move Illinois program. This slide is something that we've talked about with our customer service committee, so many of you will be seeing it for the first time today, but it does kind of lay out how electronic tolling contracts are related to one another. It's not just, you can't get electronic tolling done with just one or two partners. It is a village. And with the far left box talks about the lane contracts. Our lane technology is put into place and managed by ETC. So every time we open a new tolling point, such as Balmoral Plaza, is working with ETC to get that done, to make sure that the cameras are up, the antennas are up, the transactions are being read, and the violations are being, the transactions are being posted to IPAS, or the violations are being processed through the system to notice. The second box on the right, on the top, are the toll and IPAS processing contracts. So this is to that point about a transaction being read and posted to an IPAS account, or a violation being recorded and then sent to notice. That's what this is, and that's what the back office is. Right now, that is sitting with ETC. We are about to enter our ninth year of using that system and working with ETC on it. And we are proposing today, of course, the award of a contract for a new system that would overlap for probably a year or two with the ETC contract, so that we can make certain to have the correct implementation time and all the space we needed to make the right decisions about how that new system works. It takes a little bit of time to get a new system up and running. Now that back office system, which is again in that right box on the top, interacts with a lot of other electronic tolling contracts. We have a contract to get registered owner vehicle data whenever we have a violator and we need to figure out who that license plate belongs to. We have a web provider, and I know everyone here has talked through a lot of these procurements, so they should be somewhat familiar. We have people who do the print and mail, the correspondence distributors. We have retail distributor of inventory, that's Jewel Osco. We have collection agencies. We have various banks that we have to interact with, payment processors, credit card update service, a bunch of other tolling organizations that send us their data every single day so that we can be interoperable. This is the electronic tolling world, and it is, again, it's a village. There are a lot of organizations involved, but you can see the pivotal role that the back office plays. It's sitting there in the middle of all of that. Key milestones to date. So in June 2011, we described to the board the results of a third-party assessment of our current system. We used the term bursting at the seams, and we have been working ever since to find the best solution we can to replace what we currently have today. We want to be as prepared as possible for tomorrow and for the Move Illinois program. We, in January 2012, we met with almost 30 separate electronic tolling organizations as part of an RFI, a request for information process, where they described to us their different electronic tolling solutions. It wasn't just back office, but there were a number of back office providers who came to that. We did that as an educational step because we believed it was essential that we learn the latest landscape of the electronic tolling world before we started a true procurement process. We needed to be educated. In November of 2012, we released a request for proposal, which I will continue talking about in a little bit. In January, there was the deadline for the responses to that proposal. And then March through May of 2013, we went through a best and final offer negotiation process. The award recommendations now in June 2013. We have tried to make this a very thoughtful and very thorough process every step of the way. And we appreciate the support that many of you have given us as we've done that. From the beginning, we've outlined a number of key goals for the new system. And I just thought it might be useful from a contextual perspective to talk through them again today. The first was looking for a world-class software that's in use by large revenue organizations. Another one was looking for the depth and accessibility of development resources. So just to lend a little bit of explanation to that, today in our current system, there are only a handful of individuals nationwide who are able to actually program it. So when we need to make changes, even ones that seem very simple, we have to essentially compete with other tolling organizations that are customers of the same ETC for those programming resources. So looking for a partner who had a large number of resources and that would offer us accessibility to them makes a huge difference. And especially as we look at things like national interoperability, which no one is quite sure right now how it's going to work. So if there are going to be changes that we need to absorb in the future in this industry, we better have the best access to the best developers and the largest pool of them possible. The next one is depth and discipline of the development approach, including documentation practices. Again, if you're programming changes into a system, especially for compliance reasons with pieces of legislation or things to that effect, it is absolutely essential that they be done in a very standard, very careful, very thorough and documented way so that you do not end up with a system that feels like a mousetrap system. You know that mousetrap game where you see the ball at the top and then you see it come out the end, but it goes through so many iterations in between that it's hard to even know where you might have a point of breakage. That is the way that we believe our system has grown up to date, and we do not want to repeat that in the future. Enhanced transparency and accountability, including better monitoring and reporting. Transparency and accountability is absolutely essential. If you are an organization with annual revenues approaching $1 billion a year, it is it's something that you simply cannot live without. So looking for a software that can provide really sophisticated reporting, predictive analysis, is a huge part of what we've been seeking. Robust functionality to support future innovations, such as smartphone-based tolling. A lot of talk in the industry about smartphone-based tolling. It's actually not that hard to put a pretty smartphone application onto a smartphone to make it look like you are interacting with a tolling organization. It is much harder to pull that data all the way through the correct databases and the correct filters and to make sure that everyone who's using a smartphone with a pretty set of images on it, that it is actually posting the correct way and that you can trace a transaction backwards, and if there is a dispute, you can untangle it. So that is another thing that we really wanted to look at. If we're doing innovations, it's the window dressing of an innovation is lovely, but the true functionality of it is very important. Flexibility to accommodate future changes, such as the expansion of interoperability, we talked about that already, and the stability of the architecture and capacity for monitoring to support continuous, uninterrupted operations. I know that Joe Cambich would have a great deal to say about this particular item, because it is his headache every single time there is not continuous and uninterrupted operations. So that is, again, just the stability of the system. Very important. So the next slide here is just talking about how we went about trying to solicit quality responses. We did not want to just put an RFP on the street that said, we're a tolling organization, we need a back office, ours is aging, and please let us know what you have. We wanted to do it in a way that was so thorough and detailed that it laid the foundation for a very strong and productive partnership over the coming years. And we did this in a number of ways. We put together an RFP that had more than 7,000 detailed functional and technical requirements. We put into the RFP comprehensive process diagrams, and we did that because we actually think that tolling is so, electronic tolling at least, is so non-standard from organization to organization that describing how you do business is a huge part of helping a vendor respond to an RFP so that they can really understand what they're suggesting they get into. We asked a number of questions regarding project management practices. It's one thing to say project management, but it's another thing to really provide methodology and talk through it. We asked a number of questions regarding software development and documentation methodologies and the level of rigor and consistency imposed. We asked questions regarding system monitoring tools. We asked, and then we had mandatory software demonstrations that lasted a day each, with structured demonstration scripts with the four vendors that made it to the second round. They brought their products, and they worked through a series of very specific things that they had to show us, all the same things. Each of them had to do it the same way, show us how they would do it and what it would look like in their system.
Could you give us an example of what that would
mean? So one example was adding a field to an inventory item, a transponder inventory item. So there has always been talk in the industry about how lovely it would be if we could offer different colors of transponders. I know that seems kind of silly, but it is something that you hear talked about a lot of places. And right now, most of these systems are programmed really just for a transponder, not a whole bunch of different colors that would also translate, that would lay over different types. So we asked every vendor to show us, well, how would you add a field in inventory to show not only the serial number, the date it was issued, the date it was manufactured, and all of that stuff, and the type of transponder, is it for truck, is it for car, et cetera, but is it a license plate-based one, is it inside, but what if we also wanted to know what color it was? And they all had to show us how they would do that. And then we ask for a very detailed pricing model, because again, if you're entering a long-term partnership, it is often very helpful to have laid out from the outset a very thorough understanding on both sides